Wind was whistling in the air as the sun began to rise in the forests around Elgin, North Scotland, near modern-day Inverness. A man wakes from his cold night's rest. He couldn't get a solid night's sleep. As he gets up from the hard, cold ground next to his campfire, around him, the battle camp is bustling with activity. Men are putting on their armour and equipping themselves with weapons. The man sighs as he thinks of his home, his wife and his three children. Oh, how he misses them. Far away from home he was. He lived around Lafan with his family. He proceeds to do the same as the others around him that are awakening, putting over him a leather padded breastplate and picks up a sharpened wooden spear with an iron tip. He proceeds to attach his short sword. His sword is damaged on the edges, but it will do the job, he thinks. As he begins to drink down a cup of warm stew from his dirty wooden cup, a horn is echoed throughout the camp. He begins to line up and leave the camp, following the army over the hill. He is near the front, which makes him nervous for what is to come. As the army begins to line up across the hill in battle formation, the man sees banners from across the field beginning to rise in the distance. As what appears to be another army forming up across from them, the man gulps. He is in the second battle line. As the man looks up to the right, he sees the men around him beginning to open a pathway for a group of riders on horseback. One of these persons is clad with shiny armour pieces, a golden crown on his head, and a decently sized sword, a lot bigger than his. As the man sees this rider and his retinue reach the front, he notices the banners being carried around him. It is the king of Alba. The man feels rejuvenized, ready to fight for his king and his lands against a traitor. A man who swore his allegiance to his king. A man that was his friend, his commander. Silence succumbs to the battlefield around them as both lines of armies stare at each other. The man lifts his head and hears what he fears, a horn belching in the distance. The army opposing him begins to charge towards his ranks. The man closes his eyes, takes a deep breath, then looks up to his right and sees his king readying himself for the battle with his retinue. He is ready to die for him. As he looks forward, the enemy army approaches. He says to himself, "For Duncan the First," as he squeezes his spear ready to defend his position. His life is now in God's hand. Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland, episode 17, The Reign of Duncan the First. First thing, sorry for being gone last week. I was busy with work and other commitments, but hey, we are back. At least we're making sure we're having a minimum of 3 episodes a month. Now, a couple of things before we get started. First, yes, this is a new microphone. Yes, it may sound louder than normal. If you could please let me know in an email if it's any better or any worse, I can fine tune it. I've tuned it as best I can, but I've decided to invest since the podcast is getting popular and I wanted to sound a lot more crispier in your ears. Second, that extract that you heard at the start of the episode is a battle, a famous battle that will happen in today's episode. So stay tuned to find out what happens next. Last week, we ran a general myth-busting exercise of what the Dark Ages were defined as and what myths that were told that are actually incorrect. As we know, a lot of modern history likes to point to the Dark Ages about being a dark and horrible time, where literacy goes to die. The Dark Ages has taught us so much about history, about how one empire collapsing across Europe changed the outcome for all European countries that we see today. It was truly one of the most important and interesting times in history. But more importantly, we learnt it wasn't a time of darkness with monsters scouring the world. It was actually a time for important change, progress and learning. The foundations for which the medieval world would rise and form the nations we know of today. In terms of the Kingdom of Alba, it has grown into a bigger state than it was a few years ago. The Kingdom of Alba now has Strathclyde as a vassal state, as well as much of the west, south and east of the country. The north around Moray, however, is under the control of a distant king, relatives with a certain Macbeth about to come to the throne. So, in today's episode, we are going to be carrying on with our story. After Malcolm II's death, his grandson, Duncan the First came to the throne, starting a new dynasty in Scottish history, the House of Dunkeld. So without further ado, let's welcome to the throne, finally, Duncan the First. Duncan came to the throne through the machinations of his grandfather and immediate predecessor, Malcolm II. Duncan was the son of Malcolm's daughter, Bethoc, and Crinan, the hereditary abbot of the Columbian Monastery at Dunkeld, a church that was virtually a royal chapel for two centuries. Malcolm was one of the most important of the early Scottish kings, and the real architect of the medieval Scottish kingdom. During his reign, the Scots annexed Lothian from the Haddington Tyne to the River Tweed, and the ancient British kingdom of Strathclyde, the last of the independent British kingdoms north of Hadrian's Wall, was absorbed into the Scottish domain. More importantly, Malcolm was actively labouring to unite all Scots under his rule. Since the Scottish migrations from Del Rita into Pictavia, for generations the two dynasties had fought for overlordship of the Scots, but they had not allowed their animosity to interfere with diplomacy in the form of marriage. One branch of this held the lands in the fief, holding a minor small kingdom north of the Kingdom of Alba. In the first quarter of the 11th century, there was sent from the fief family, Lorraine, a princess named Grunach, a distant cousin of Duncan, whose first husband was a cousin of the famous Macbeth, named Gilia. They produced a son named Lorca before Gilia was burned to death in 1033. The burning of Gilia leads to an unfortunate aspect of 11th century Scottish history, civil war within both the northern and southern dynasty families. Duncan's grandfather, Malcolm II, had taken kingship in 1005, at the conclusion of a civil war that had plagued his dynasty since 961, as we spoke about in our previous episodes. Malcolm slew a prince of the fief's family, Grucock's nephew. The member of the fief's prince apparently was insurance that Duncan's claim to the crown would not be challenged by someone whose fitness to the king he was equal to, or better than his own. Because remember, this idea of primogeniture only came in during Malcolm II's father, so it's still relatively new, so killings were the best way to still secure the throne for your son. Among the kingdom that was north of Alba, a similar war was raging. Macbeth's father, Findlac, was slain by his nephews in 1020. One of them, Malcolm MacBail, succeeded him as king. On Malcolm's death in 1029, Macbeth succeeded to the kingship. When considering the murder of Gilia and another nephew and the brother of Malcolm Mac, suspicion must fall on Macbeth, a suspicion that begins almost certain when Macbeth named Gilia's widow, apparently in an effort to restore peace among the warrior factions. Macbeth's grasp on the northern kingship appears to have been tenuous. One indication is his marriage to Grecoc, an effort to reconcile the family that had slain his father. Another indication is that Macbeth apparently submitted to Malcolm II and ruled his lands as Malcolm's subregulus. Malcolm II, for his part, was then the overlord of all the Scots. Although his immediate rule was limited to the lands south of the Campanians, Macbeth must have submitted soon after his ascension to the Alban kingship, if not before, as he was a member of Malcolm's party when Malcolm met the English king, Cnut, in 1031. This is the famous meeting that potentially either took place in England or in Rome, where Malcolm refused to submit fully to Cnut. Macbeth's submission would account for the description of Macbeth as Duncan's dux by the contemporary chronicler Marius Scotius in the 11th century. Dux had meaning of subordinate ruler as well as the meaning of military commander. This dux title, or duke as we now know of it today, was obviously in the Roman times and only started to appear around this time in Scottish history. The instability attending Macbeth's reign in the north was also present during Duncan's reign in the south. The murders Malcolm committed on Duncan's behalf had alienated a branch of his dynasty and appeared to be an anticipation that Duncan's claims to kingship, based on his mother's kinship to royal dynasty, were likely to meet with opposition. In order to give Duncan an independent base of power, Malcolm set Duncan up as king over the newly acquired Kingdom of Strathclyde, also known as Cumbria, as we touched on in the last episode. To add support, Duncan married into the family of the Northumbrian Earl Sibwood. who would later lead an invasion of Scotland on behalf of Malcolm Canmore. This is the son of Duncan. Malcolm Canmore is a person who will eventually avenge his father and kill his father's murderer, Macbeth. Duncan's brother would also marry into the Northumbrian line, and his descendants would prosper on the Anglo-Scottish border. Although only three specific military events are known from Duncan's reign, it is clear that his reign was not successful. In the year 1038, the territory of Strathclyde was raided by the Northumbrians. Duncan retaliated in 1040 by leading a raid against the Northumbrian cathedral town of Durham. His raid was a complete failure. The Scots were driven from Durham and Duncan retreated northwards. Macbeth may have been a member of Duncan's army. One of the duties of a duke was to act as a commander in the army of his overlord. Later that year, Duncan made a royal circuit of Macbeth's lands. The feud had ended in Macbeth's favour, and Duncan's defeat at Durham may have convinced Macbeth that Duncan's overlordship could be challenged after the disasters of the 1038-1040 campaign in Northumbria. On the 16th of August 1040, as we heard at the start of this episode near Elgin, Duncan's troops were challenged by Macbeth's forces, and in the ensuing battle, Duncan I was slain. Macbeth assumed the kingship of both the northern and southern kingdoms and had direct rule over all the Scots, rather than a vague overlordship over them, which was similar to what Duncan had. The difference being, Duncan's was more of an overlordship similar to Connaught, whereas Macbeth assumed direct control and had control of the actual provinces in Scotland at this time. Yes, he was the commander of Duncan's armies. Yes, he was a duke and was subordinate to Duncan, and he did betray him in that manner, which is why obviously the later stories would explain this. But we'll touch more on Macbeth, his role, and how he's viewed by actual historical chronicles in next week's episodes. Let's more focus on Duncan's reign. Contemporary estimation of Duncan's reign are furnished by the records preserved in the Irish Chronicles, the Annals of Ulster, and the Annals of Tigermarch, and the Chronicles of Marius Scotius. The Irish took more than a casual interest in both Malcolm II and Duncan, because Malcolm's mother was a Lannister woman. Irish fascination with Malcolm is reflected in his obituary in the Annals of Tigermarch, where he is called the glory of the whole of the Western Europe. Marius Scotianus begins his record of Scottish material with Malcolm's death and gives the only precise chronological information for Duncan's ascension and death. He states that Malcolm died on the 25th of November 1034, and Duncan reigned from the 30th of November 1034 until the 16th of August 1040, a mere 6 years. Both Tigermarch and Ulster state that Duncan was slain by his own people, testifying to his lordship of Macbeth's lands. Within two generations of his death, estimation on Duncan's reign and character appear in the Scottish historical literature. An early poetic account of Duncan's reign is provided by a contemporary verse history of the kings of Ireland and Scotland known as Prophecy of Berchan, composed in the second half of the 11th century. Berchan used a lot of verses to identify the kings, but comparison of reign lengths with the order of kings in the poem allows for a fairly certain identification. In the verses dealing with Duncan, he is called the man of many diseases, which meant a man of many illnesses. A more recent edition and translation of the Scottish verses in Berchan is King Duncan the First of many diseases. The king will not be young, but he will be old. He will turn against the hostages of the Gaels. Alba will not be attacked in his time. The man of many diseases, of many maladies, the standard of good gold assuring battle, he will be a prosperous old man. Joy to Alba, which he will govern, but short the time he will enjoy for her. 5.5 years, a bright space over Alba in high kingship. After the diseased king will take the kingship, his name, the many of many diseases, he will desire of that disease. That will be his high deed. The statement in Berchan that Scotland was peaceful during Duncan's reign is echoed by John of Fordon, who claims that Scotland was not attacked during Duncan's reign. Even if one assumes that the attack on Strathclyde and the failed raid on Durham were foreign events, Duncan's battle with Macbeth would indicate at least one hostile attack, as that was in Scottish lands. The Bachan verses show a curious difference of opinion about Duncan. They suggest that within half a century of Duncan's death, there was a deliberate introduction of dynastic bias in Scottish historical records, a bias that would be carried into later accounts. The writer in Bachan may have been attached to St. Andrews and a partisan of the family allied with Macbeth. The Bachan verses on the Fee family are very favourable, while the verses on Duncan's family were less than enthusiastic. To a great extent, though, modern interpretations of early Scottish history are based on two revisions of the historical records. One carried out during the reign of Duncan's great-great-grandson William the Lion, about the year 1167, and a second revision, St. Andrews, is the only Scottish church mentioned in the poem, sees around 1234. There is an unusual amount of detail concerning kings who made their home in the Fief. Part of the revision was clearly an effort by the nobles to reflect current political realities. This is seen in the revision of the royal Scottish genealogies from the 10th to 12th centuries. That situation of rough parity is reflected by Fordon, who notes that the different branches of the royal dynasty, the family of Constantine and the family of Malcolm, were competing for kingship in the late 10th and early 11th centuries. Fordon presents the competition as Malcolm II defending his right to the kingship against usurpers, whilst Fortin presents the battle as mere a dynastic infighting. The location of Duncan's death outside Illigan is mentioned. There are pieces of information that may be connected with the efforts of Alexander II on behalf of his ancestor. On the 21st of April in 1235, Alexander endowed a mass chaplaincy in Elgin Cathedral for the soul of Duncan. 3 marks were given annually from the royal borough of Elgin for that purpose. Alexander's interest in Duncan may account for a renewed interest in him, both literary and historical. Not only can specific places of literature be identified with certain views, but certain times can be identified with an interest in Duncan. The reigns of Malcolm Canmore, Duncan I's son and known as Malcolm III, and Alexander II. While that interest may reflect no more than the records that are now extinct, or in case of Malcolm, a certain failure of piety, there are political considerations for both kings that may have influenced the literature of the time. Both kings were actively involved in affairs in the lands formerly ruled by the kings. Malcolm Canmore, Duncan I's son, was active in his efforts to establish his lordship over Moray, which was obviously where Macbeth had become king. He led an invasion there, and he needed to establish that those rights were his by virtue of his father's overlordship. At the same time, the reign of Macbeth would need to be discredited to discourage opposition both in Moray and in the Fief. At that time, the king in the north was a son of Macbeth's stepson, Lulloch. Malcolm launched an invasion of Moray in 1078. According to John of Fordon's and Andrew of Winnerton, the respective treatments of Duncan's reign, one can gain some estimation of the differences in sources and views reflected in the productions of Wharton and Fordon. Fordon's assessment on Duncan and his reign is also found in the later accounts that were the predecessors of Shakespeare's drama. According to Fordon, Duncan was a noble king whose great fault was trusting too well his enemies, led by Macbeth. Duncan is compared to the Roman emperors Vespasian and Titius. The comparison with Titius reinforces the notion of a good but ineffective king. Fordon supplies the information that Duncan was slain by Macbeth himself at Bothagon near Elgin. From his account, it is clear that Duncan was making a royal circuit customary for the Gaelic overlord through his territories. Macbeth is distinguished merely as a leader of the family of the former kings of Constantine III and Grim, or more commonly known as Kenneth III. Those kings had been defeated by supporters of Duncan's grandfather, Malcolm II. According to Fordon, the families of those kings had slain Malcolm, and the implication by Fordon is that Macbeth was one of the dissidents within the dynasty of Malcolm. At several points in his narrative, Fordon is slightly confused. First, Malcolm belonged to the family, as did Constantine and Kenneth, but Constantine belonged to a different branch of that dynasty distinct from Malcolm or Kenneth, as we touched on in the past episodes, obviously Kenneth being the one who died and Malcolm being his son, etc. Warrington's account of Duncan's reign is similar to that given by Fordon, to the extent that Duncan is portrayed as a good king, following in his footsteps of his grandfather. Warrington then introduced a material not in Fordon's work. He claims that Duncan, already the father of 2 children, fathered a third on the daughter of a miller at Fortford. The illegitimate child was Malcolm III, or Malcolm Canmore. He would reign from 1058 to 1093, but that is in for a future episode for us. Warrington continues to diverge from the account given by Fordun by claiming that Macbeth was not merely the leader of the opposition to Duncan, but was Duncan's nephew, the son of his sister. Thus, the crime of regicide is further compounded by the more grievous sin, in medieval eyes, of kinslaying, a crime that you rarely see later medieval history is where you start to see it a lot more. Around the 13 to 1400s, England has a massive testament to kinslaying. Fordun's account shown signs of access to the literacy traditions connected with the court of Duncan's descendants, Malcolm Canmore and Alexander II. One sign of that is a reference to Duncan's death. Fordun gives the precise name of the place together with the precise details of the event leading to Duncan's death. Warrington does not. Fordun presents Duncan much as the revised verses in Perchant. Duncan was a good king with little opportunity to prove his worth. A discreet silence substitutes for Duncan's military failures or the murderous machinations of his grandfather. The account given by Warrington, however, is interesting in the details it provides. While one cannot discount the possibility that Warrington's details were the product of his imagination, Ormius research indicates that Warrington was an extreme conservative historian and little given to speculation, unlike Fordun. More importantly, Warrington had access to the Warrington uses, the term to describe Duncan's relationship to Macbeth. There are various translations of the Erne, including mere relationship, but Warrington states in the text that Macbeth was Duncan's nephew. In the records from Malcolm III's court, such as Duncan being remembered as a king and his ill health may have been remembered as his old age, Warrington, on the other hand, was writing in the fief, in the home territory of Duncan's dynastic rivals, such as, obviously, Macbeth. Warrington's material reflects a non-partisan view. Duncan's reign was not seen through rose-tinted spectacles, and Macbeth was not considered merely a villain. Warrington mentions that Macbeth ruled well as a king, a conclusion supported by the contemporary records. Warrington, however, is not a partisan of Macbeth. He condemned the murder of Duncan in strong terms, and his description of the machinations by Malcolm Canmore, Duncan the first son, to dispose Macbeth are comparable to the description given by Fordun. That Fordun relates more information about Macbeth than does Fordun was noted by Nora Chadwick, who considered Warrington almost an encyclopedia of medieval legends about Macbeth. Warrington was in a position to access to material concerning both Duncan and Macbeth in the 11th century. St. Circe was a recipient of land grants from Macbeth and Greyoc, as well as from Malcolm Canmore. Notices of their grants still survive today. St. Circe also possessed a library at least as early as the 11th century, although a 12th century inventory shows that the most of the identical manuscripts were unreadable texts. One should remember that such texts were often utilised as registers for charters and records of pertinent historical memorabilia. Warrington's information on Macbeth's kingship to Duncan and the circumstances surrounding the relationship of Macbeth to Duncan is a problem that may influence the interpretation of the different literacy traditions. That kinship between Malcolm II and Macbeth was claimed by the Chronicle of Huntingdon, an English chronicle that was used by Edward I in his efforts to abdicate the Scottish crown. There, Macbeth is called Malcolm's nepus. The information in the Chronicle of Huntingdon is important. It has been demonstrated that incorporated in that chronicle is a narrative cognate to the brief Scottish chronicle in the Poplarton manuscript. One may suggest that some name and some kinship between Macbeth and Duncan, a kinship that's closer than a relationship implied by Macbeth's marriage to Cronach, Warrington claims that Macbeth was a frequent guest of Duncan I and insists that Duncan and Macbeth were related. But his suggestion that Duncan was Macbeth's uncle is unlikely. Warrington calls Duncan Macbeth's Erne. That may be a faulty translation of the Latin nepos. In medieval Latin texts, nepos could mean an undefined kinship as well as specific meaning of grandson, and by the late Middle Ages it could be translated as nephew. In the Chronicle of Melrose, the word nepos is used to describe the relationship of Duncan to Malcolm II. In the Chronicle of Huntingdon, nepos is used to design the relationship of Macbeth to Malcolm II. Later writers, such as Hector Bayuc, claim that Macbeth's mother was the daughter of Malcolm II and gave her the name Doeba. Hector Biot goes on to say Macbeth was a leader of the family of Constantine, yet at the same time he goes to some lengths to assert that Malcolm II had only one child, who was Duncan's mother. The question is far from resolved, and one must not be too hasty in setting aside Wyton's claim of close kinship between Duncan and Macbeth. If Wyton's account is correct in proposing a kinship between Duncan and Macbeth, as well as the circumstances surrounding the birth of Malcolm Canmore, Malcolm IV, Duncan the first son, then the absence of that information from Fordon's account suggests one of two things. Either there is a bias, conscious or unconscious, in Fordon's narrative, or he did not search as diligently for his material as has been suggested. Wyton was using materials from St. Andrews that are no longer extinct, including the Great Register. The question is, did Wyton get his information about Duncan from St. Andrews' source? The answer is probably yes, especially in the light of the Andrews' connections with Macbeth. Fordon, however, must have been aware of the various materials available at St. Andrews. Indeed, his chronicle makes use of the Great Register. Interestingly, the parish church of Fordon, Fordon's home, was within a diocese of St. Andrews itself. In conclusion, one can see at least two divergent traditions in medieval Scottish literature when the history of Duncan I is examined. Historians have set out the lines of descent for the material used by Fordon and Wyton in their narratives on early Scottish kingship. What is clear is that there was dynastic bias in Fordon's account of Duncan's reign, but the introduction of dynastic bias may have occurred much earlier than proposed by historians in their study of Fordon's chronicle. The problems presented, not just by Duncan's reign, but also his qualifications for the kingship, may be the reason for the early and different estimations of him. Those parallel traditions can be seen as early as the 11th century in the prophecy of Birchan. One tradition, critical of Duncan, might be placed in the faith in the records kept at St. Andrews. Another tradition favourable to Duncan can be identified as early as the reign of Malcolm IV, Malcolm Canmore. Yet, both men preserve valuable traditions of historical and literary memory. The difference in accounts of Duncan's career given by Fordon and by Wyton may not be merely difference in materials, but rather the viewpoint of those materials and the ultimate goal of the writer. When reading Fordon's narrative, then, one must be aware of the distinct possibility that Fordon was deliberately omitting or editing materials to conform to his interpretation of history. This need not be considered in a wholly unfavourable sense. Doubtless there were some conflicting traditions that could not be reconciled, and Fordon may have done no more than choose one version than another. Wyton, on the other hand, used an encyclopedic approach in presenting the materials for his narrative, and was not distressed by resulting contradictions, either implied or apparent. During his lifetime, Duncan I was an unsuccessful king, with a dubious right to the kingship. Yet the success of his son, Malcolm Canmore, in recapturing the kingship from Macbeth, and the success of his descendants in holding that kingship, ensured that Duncan I's reign and the House of Dunkeld was far more interesting to later generations than it might have been otherwise. In this examination of the various estimations of Duncan I's reign, it has been suggested that one can detect different interpretations of Duncan's reign, and those interpretations may reflect in the Scottish literature. Reflections of the literacy are quite possibly reflections of the opposition to or support for Duncan and his dynasty within Scotland. The words themselves may reflect the deeply held feelings of friends and foes. So, let's leave Duncan the First there, shall we? Just as he was betrayed and dying to Macbeth on the battlefield. The new king of both the north of Scotland and the kingdom of Alba. Macbeth joined together the north, which was Moray, and the lands of the kingdom of Alba under one house and one rule, which now pretty much is most of Scotland under this rule. How times have changed. I wonder if Macbeth's rule will be a famous one. Guess we'll have to wait till next week for that one. As I mentioned, next week we'll be going over the true story of Macbeth, what was the real history behind Macbeth, his lineage, and what actually happened within the context of the history of Scotland. Who actually was he? Where was his true lineage from? How did he become king in the north of Scotland first? How did he submit to Duncan I? And finally, how did he take and then lose the throne of both the north of Scotland and the kingdom of Alba? After that, we'll have a look at the story of the fiction of Macbeth by Shakespeare and how the story was created and told throughout the years. Where did things diverge from the truth? Thank you to everyone for the continued support on this series as well. Really enjoying a steady commitment to the show, but honestly, it does mean a lot to see the support we are getting. As always, any corrections or issues with this podcast, please let me know at thehistoryofscotland@gmail.com. That is historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. Please leave a review if you can, and our podcast is always available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, and many other great podcasting sites. Until then, folks, have a great week. Our podcast will be on as normal next week. Stay safe, enjoy the bank holiday, and I'll catch you all on the next one. Peace.